Sometimes a new neighbor can be like a surprise package from fate. A gift you didn't ask for, you weren't expecting, and you might even prefer to return unopened. But sometimes the eccentric, odd, even challenging neighbor turns out to be one of the best things that ever happened to you. Alexander Masters had an experience like this. He's a writer who lives in Cambridge, England, in a house with one of those downstairs basement apartments. And the neighbor in that basement is named Simon. He's this tall, shambling recluse. He lives in the dark on a diet of tinned kippers and ramen mix, and he's obsessed with bus timetables. He's also one of the greatest mathematical prodigies of the 20th century. Masters wrote a wonderful book recently about his brilliant neighbor. It's called Simon, The Genius in My Basement. When he and Jim Fleming sat down to talk, they began with a reading from the book.
Schlush, dunk, dunk, schwap, dunk, schwap. Listen, can you hear? Dunk, schlish, dunk, swap, schwap, dunk. Bend down. Put your ear against the carpet. Schwap, dunk, 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 schwap, dunk, schlish. Lish, dunk, 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 schwap, dunk, schlish, dunk. Dunk, schwap, schlish, dunk. That's the sound of a once-in-a-generation genius. Simon Phillips Norton. Phillips, with an S, as if one Philip were not enough to contain his brilliance. He lives under my floorboards. Dunk, dunk, dunk. There's another very important sound, which is too difficult to represent typographically. An intermittent, twisted crackle, sharp but thick, with a strong sense of command, resting on a base of plosive disorder. It's the sound of plastic bag being opened in a hurry and the gratification of discovering important papers inside. Without understanding this noise, you cannot understand the man. Schlish dunk, schwap, schwap, dunk dunk. Simon has been pacing down there for 27 years, 3 months, 5 days, 13 hours, and 8 minutes. Shh! Stop breathing. Did you catch that? Still another sort of noise. A sort of sigh. That was a thought.
What an extraordinary neighbor you have had.
Yes, he was quite remarkable. Well, he still is. He's still my neighbor.
What did you know of him when you moved there?
Very little. He was the odd fellow on the street. I knew that, and I'd seen him about on the streets, wandering about, you know, with his wild hair and his torn trousers and his shoes quite often flapping, and he always had this bag and this slightly glazed look in his eyes. But I knew very little about him. He seemed fairly amiable, pleasant sort of bloke, but I didn't know much about his background at all.
You weren't worried at all about it. This was a slightly odd man, but after all, you weren't going to be living with him just in the same house.
No, I wasn't worried about him at all. I mean, he's obviously completely harmless and nice enough. I'd said hello to him a couple of times on the streets, and he charged a very, very decent rent for this room, and it was a pleasant room, and I liked it because he wasn't going to be one of those sort of ghastly, interfering landlords who would sort of try and introduce you to their family or something like this. You know, he was just going to let you be, and you'd get on with it, and he'd get on with whatever he was doing. So he seemed to me a perfectly genial and pleasant person to have, you know, to be paying a little bit of money to every week.
How long did it take before you began to realize that there was more to him than a slightly pleasant man who was your landlord?
As anyone, as always happens when you get a peculiar-looking character in a street, there are rumors going around that he was a frazzled-out genius and these dreadful things had happened and his life was a terrible disappointment. Or, you know, there was some sort of fable that was going on around in the streets about him, and particularly in a city like Cambridge, where there are quite a lot of people who looked like Simon. And for each of them, there is a little set of anecdotes that builds up a little myth about them. So I heard those, and that they had to do with maths immediately intrigued me. So then I started to ask him about that. He's a man completely without vanity and no desire to boast about himself at all. But it turned out that he wasn't just any old mathematician. He was, at his peak, really the greatest thing England had. So I was immediately in awe of him and delighted to find that I was a tenant in the house of such a man. But I didn't think at that point of writing anything about him, partly because writing about mathematics is famously the way to end all chances of book sales. But then I thought, for goodness sake, you know, the stuff he works on, he works in an area of mathematics known as group theory. I won't go into that now, but it's a fairly simple area to sort of to understand the basic elements. But the special area he worked on was a group. It's a measure of symmetry, a type of study in mathematics. And it was monstrously difficult and monstrously large. So it was known as the monster group. Well, that was quite an intriguing phrase, and I liked that. And then he worked on a special area of it that had some particularly unexpected consequences, because it had seemed like a very abstract and an area of mathematics that had no practical application at one time. Suddenly, this stuff, apparently out of nowhere, had practical applications right at the fundamental layers of physics. And so they called that moonshine. And so the area he worked in was called monstrous moonshine. And I thought to myself, I don't care what that is, someone has to write about it. That is so good, that title.
I can see exactly why you would find that so appealing. But at the same time, there must have been at least a part of your mind that said, first, can this possibly be true? This is such a good story that it sounds as though someone made it up. And then the temptation must also have been to focus not on the mathematician, but on the eccentric.
Oddly enough, when I first started writing the book, no one thought of it as an interesting story. Everyone said, I don't believe you can possibly write a book about Simon. It's not possible. He has so little interest in the resonant phrase. He has very little sort of sense of romantic anecdote, romantic in the old-fashioned sense, you know, of having a good dramatic element to it. He's just not material for a book, because he doesn't take joy in the sort of things that you want the hero of a book to take joy in. And there were people who were saying to me, you know, I find it difficult to meet Simon because, and these would be mathematicians saying this to me, he represents to me such a display of failure. Here was this man who was at one point the top of every aspiration as far as a mathematician goes, and now is at the bottom. You know, he's this disheveled character living in your basement whose principal interest is now buses and trains. Why would you want to write about this person?
But, you know, when I hear you talk about this, it suddenly strikes me that that's exactly why you can. You talk about how people have difficulty reading about mathematics and being interested in mathematics. And in some ways, Simon is exactly the kind of person we want to introduce us to it, because our memories, for most of us, even those of us who loved mathematics, was of the brain drain that went into memorizing multiplication tables when we were seven. Whereas Simon really spoke math, didn't he? Almost
yes.
Out of the womb.
Well, and the great pleasure I found in speaking to him and getting, he's terribly, terribly generous as well. He was always, you know, I would bumble along trying desperately to understand the basic elements of his subject and fail. And he would begin very straightforwardly over again with a slightly different set of images to try and let me understand that way. And the thing I found about him in his discussion of his upbringing as a mathematician is actually the sort of maths that you and I might have found hard work at school. It didn't interest him in the slightest, to be honest. He found that very dull, clunking through those sort of endless algebraic proofs. His whole attitude to maths was you had a result, there was some sort of result, which may have been a result the teacher had set you to prove, let's say. You wanted to find 15 ways of getting there, not just one, not just the boring one of going through all that algebraic stuff. You wanted to find images, you wanted to find metaphors, you wanted to find odd connections with other types of ways of representing numbers, and you might dream them up on the spot. And they might hold for a little bit, just hold sufficiently for you to establish some connection that made this answer a necessary result. What didn't interest him is the sort of memorizing of timetable stuff that certainly, when I was a child, that's what I was forced to do, and quite rightly, I needed to learn my times tables, but I didn't have that spark, that artistic spark that made Simon so distinctive as a great mathematician.
You know, I like that you call him an artist, because I think that may help us to move to the other Simon, the Simon who no longer cares about maths, at least not in that way, but does care, and I guess his obsession with transportation is actually a form of artistry, isn't it? He's interested, he looks at it and sees it as a problem that deserves to be solved.
Yes, and I think for him, the idea of a sort of sense of completeness, of a neatness, of a structure that works is what really, I think for Simon there is a great sense of a neatness, of a structure that it isn't neat yet, and it ought to be made neat. And so he's constantly firing off letters to politicians and saying, look, you should do this in a different way. And he's usually right. You know, he's figured out some much better way to do things.
Part of what I like about that, I have to confess, is that the immediate response to someone like Simon is to suggest that he is Well, autism is a word that would be applied often to that, but...
I mean, after speaking to Simon, getting to know him well, I decided I was not going to mention the word autism in the book. I'm sick of the word autism. People are just bandied about all over the place. Now, I have no doubt that it is often correctly bandied about, but people are starting to boast about it. You know, I'm a bit autistic, they'll say at some supper party, and they say, no, you're not. You're just either a bit boring or a bit weird, but you're not autistic. You know, autism is a proper illness, and people who have autistic children, that is a hard thing to deal with. And so it's become a kind of a facile word to use. Well, in Simon's case, if he is, it's not interesting, really, because in what way does it advance you to an understanding of Simon? If it doesn't, it takes you away from an understanding of Simon, because if you try and understand Simon as someone who has an enormous talent that, you know, and you want to have some sense of what it feels like to have that talent or what it feels like to lose that talent, because that was the particular thing that interested me with Simon. I think there are many books written about geniuses, but not many about the loss of genius. What does it feel like to have a sense of something being taken from you? Then to place him already in a distant category is not going to help. Mm. And I think also with someone like Simon, how can you tell? I mean, he grows up from the age of 3, well, 1.5, but I mean, by the time it became very evident, 3 or 4, he's already finding it difficult to speak to the kids around him because he thinks so much quicker than they do. He has so many things to delight him that they don't. I mean, they will be playing with balls and stuff like that, but he's got this intellectual delight that they don't yet have. By the time he's 15, there's no one in the whole town he can talk to because none of them is up to him. But imagine being a child who feels so isolated from his peers. Of course he's going to grow up weird.
Yeah.
Is he odd as a consequence of his genius, or is he odd as a consequence of some boring thing like autism, which, as I say, I'm not terribly interested in? I don't think you can pick it out. I think this is just Simon. It's Simon as he grew up in this odd situation with this incredibly rare talent.
Now, the other thing he has, of course, is a biographer who did get interested in him, not in the oddity of him, but in him. You really have gotten to know him, haven't you?
Yes, well, I've known him now for probably 15 years. When was it I moved in? In the mid-90s. Mid-late 90s, I moved in there. So it was about 15 years, I'd have thought. And, you know, he was a very pleasant landlord. He was not interfering. I would have various parties and invite him up to the parties, and he'd come up. And he has this quite odd manner if you have a party and there's everyone standing about. And he's a lot better at it now, but he used to be a bit odd about how he'd approach someone if there was a group he wanted to talk to. He couldn't quite figure out how to get involved in the conversation. So what he'd do is he'd come up with an enormous bus timetable. He'd run downstairs to his basement, pick up this enormous bus timetable and open it up. And so his finger was resting in the middle of the enormous timetable and then wait for the conversation. And he'd inch up to this group of conversationalists, inch up to it with a bus timetable at the ready, and then wait for the name of a town to pop up. And he'd quickly find it in the bus timetable, leap into the conversation and say, yes, there's a bus going there. And then he'd tell you about it. Now, that allowed, because he just couldn't figure out how to do it. Once in the conversation, he was fine. And it was just the introducing himself to the conversation that went through this odd way.
So, you know, I can hear the smile in your voice. There's a smile in your voice as you describe this, but I am left with a wonder if you didn't worry about it a little when you first invited him to a party. This is not the way most people engage in conversation.
No, but on the other hand, there was no aggression in it. It was perfectly clear that there was no sort of underlying current going on. You know, he was being absolute. This is the way he did things. He wasn't trying to disguise anything. He wasn't trying to say something on the sly. He was being obviously very straight in Simon's way of being straight. And you just appreciate that instantly. And everyone would say at the end, you know, who is that weird but really lovely man? It was so nice. Because I think also just to find someone who, I mean, for me, the word that always accompanies Simon is a sense of delight. And the enthusiasm of him for whatever has taken his fancy is so nice to see, because it's not tempered in any way. It's not tempered by some sort of attempt to swagger or show off or be sophisticated. No, if he likes a thing and he feels enthusiastic about it, he goes for it.
You and Simon get along very well. You've become friends. What is it you think that makes you friends?
I find, to me, I have enormous respect for him as well, because I think to have achieved what he's achieved, I have this phenomenal talent to kind of see it fade, not kind of, just to see it fade, and to remain yet essentially, and I think this is very important, a happy man is a huge triumph, because I've never met a mathematician like that. And I've met very few people who have had a sense of disappointment in their life who don't subsequently resent it for the rest of their lives. Simon somehow has managed to get through that continue to fill his life with a sense of purpose and value, and to go out and do something he feels is socially important. Now, I have huge respect for that. So I think that's certainly why I want to maintain a friendship with him and would regard him as my friend, because he's someone I respect, who I feel has done something that's powerful and important. And also, I don't want to go in a teacherly way like this, but I feel it's instructive. I feel here's someone to emulate. And I like that about Simon, who is so without swagger about himself, so is essentially, he's not really modest in the sense that he doesn't sort of play down his capacities. He's just not interested in elevating or demoting them. He just is what he is. And it's a very refreshing person to be with, someone who you don't have to spend a lot of time interpreting what they really mean, because Simon will tell you what he really means, and then he'll get up and go off and look up another bus timetable.
Alexander Masters' biography of Simon Norton is called Simon, The Genius in My Basement. Jim Fleming talked with him.